This is the May 14 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Merrill Crowley. He's at First Choice Commodities in Watseka, Illinois. Kurt Kimmel is here from Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. And Wayne Nelson joins us from L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana. Our special guest for the day is Ted Seifried. He is with Zahner Ag Hedge out of Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Ted, thank you for being with us. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself first, please?
Well, hey, Todd. Thanks for having me. As you said, my name is Ted Seifried. I'm from Zahner Ag Hedge. I run the agricultural hedge division of a brokerage firm based out of Chicago. And we do most of our work working with, I'd say, 70% producers and about 30% end users. And we work exclusively with them to try to get to know their operation as much as we possibly can in order to guide them as if we were part of their operation. As far as my background, grew up in Western Illinois. My father was a dentist, but we had a 36-acre hobby farm growing up. We moved to the Chicagoland area when I was 13. Went to school back in Western Illinois for agricultural economics, which eventually took me over to Europe for a year and 8 months to finish my economics degree. But I also took on an internship with a dairy company called Caverco. And when I came back from that, I walked onto the floor and really never left. While I might have left before, I stuck with the business, and to this point, I've been doing it for about 16 years now. So I really enjoy it. I love watching markets. I love talking about corn, wheat, soybeans, cattle, and hogs, dairy as well. Aside from that, I also really like cars. I have a penchant for ethanol, mainly because of my interest in cars. And also, I suppose, my interest in corn.
Do you race?
So, yeah, we have, the owner of my company and I have a membership to the Joliet Autobahn, which is outside of Chicago, and we go out there and do time attacks on the track a couple times a year. And I've got my 702 horsepower E85 powered Cadillac CTSV that I like to rip around the track in.
Oh, nice. I was making a guess given your comment about ethanol. I hadn't seen that somewhere else, so I thought maybe that was the case. One other thing from you. How is it that you decided to go back to Macomb and to major in ag econ, being a dentist's son that at 13 clearly went to high school in the Chicago area?
Right. Yeah. So a lot of it had to do with wanting to go back and see my friends who were all going to Western. But then also, I didn't really have the clear-cut agriculture economics degree in mind. I started out as econ, and my advisor sat me down and said, hey, you know you're an ag econ major, right? And I'm like, no, I'm an econ major. So she slides over my transcript, the classes that I've been taking, and she says, you're an ag econ major. So I kind of said, okay, yeah, I see your point. So let's go with that. And then she dropped it on me and said, hey, you know, we want to give out a scholarship for somebody to go study abroad in the Netherlands. It's usually help for the number one person in the ag econ department, but the number one and number two are Chinese exchange students that are here, and they don't want to go anywhere else because they're already studying abroad. So if you want to go, just write me a one-page letter, and we'll give you a scholarship to do so. So that was kind of just the whole thing fell in my lap, and it just all felt right, you know?
So the Netherlands, if you spent time on a dairy there, that had to be an interesting, maybe not because you didn't come from an ag background here, but it's just done differently there. Not potentially the production side, but how they have to deal with the European Union and the regulatory functions.
Absolutely. And so this was one of the largest dairy companies in the world. At the time, Caverco, now Friesland Block. And what they were doing in the project that they brought me in on is they have subsidiaries really all over the world, and their marketing plans and all of their central strategy was all in different languages. So they wanted to take their main strategy and make it uniform throughout the company. And to do that, they wanted to translate it from Dutch to English. So all of this paperwork was being translated. They were sending it to me to just kind of go over to make sure everything looked right. So it was really very simple work on my end, but I'm getting to read all of their regulation and everything like that. So that was really very interesting for me. And then when I came back to the States and stepped into the dairy pit, because one of my good friend's fathers was a broker in the dairy pit, and My friend was one of his clerks, and they said to me, "Hey, you know, business is good. We need another clerk. How do you feel about working on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange?" And I said, "Yeah, that sounds amazing. Let's do that." And so it just all kind of snowballed from there. And I really, it feels like my path was decided before I even started walking down it, you know?
What was your first job at the CME in the pit?
Yeah, so I was a runner in the dairy pit. And then I went from being a runner to a phone clerk and outtrade clerk. And then I started filling paper in the pit. Then I went over to the Chicago Board of Trade because we needed, at the time I was working for R.J. O'Brien, and they needed somebody over there. So I went over to the Chicago Board of Trade. And then ultimately, one of the institutional brokers at R.J. O'Brien, Cindy Yeaman, said, "Hey, you know, we've been doing a lot of business through you. You've got good insight in the markets. I want somebody to come off the floor and be a broker upstairs and deal with some of our institutional clients, you know, Frito-Lay, General Mills, things like that." And I thought that was a super interesting opportunity. So I jumped at that, did that for almost 5 years. But that was at a time where the industry was changing. You know, it wasn't so much about needing advice on strategies or where the market was going or sort of insight, because all of the commercials, you know, they had guys like me in-house. They had, you know, guys they paid a ton of money to that were making decisions on the market. So basically it just became about execution, which means our profit margins were really getting cut to nothing as we're all competing for the same big clients. And that's when I decided, you know what, I can take a lot of these option strategies that a lot of these big players are using and kind of flip them over for the producer side of things and really cater towards the farmer, you know, the mid to large size guy that, you know, they're doing 20 different things on any given day. Watching the markets is one of them, but it can't be their focus all of the time. Well, for me, that's the only hat I wear. I'm good at it, and I'm good at using the strategies to, you know, give us opportunities to manage risk. So I saw that as an opportunity, and I kind of ran with it. And about 10 years ago, I was recruited to come and take over start Zahner Ag Hedge, a division of the Zahner brokerage firm. And I've been doing that ever since.
All right, so I have a bin full of corn. This is actually true. And I need an option strategy because I think we'll need to get rid of it. But if you have one to help me recoup some of the losses on that bin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do I do?
Well, you know, personally, I'm fairly friendly on the market right now. You know, we got the big USDA report on Tuesday out of the way. We were thinking that, at least a large portion of the trade was thinking that could be a lot worse than what the actual number was. You know, a lot of people were looking for new crop to be somewhere 3.5 to 3.8 billion. It did not end up being that. So I think seasonally, we're in a position where we can start to see a bit of a rally. Yes, the idea of 97 million acres is going to keep a little bit of a lid on things, but the funds are really very short. So I'm looking for a little bit of a recovery here. We're going to call it a Texas edge. But in my mind, any way that we can add pennies to bushels is a fair game when it comes to marketing. So I really like the idea of coming in and owning, say, like a 320, 350 call spread out in the July. Been able to do that for about 7.5, 7.75 cents. I think you walk away with 30 to 40 cents on that. And, you know, if you get the recovery on the cash side of things as well, you put those two things together, and all of a sudden you are in a much better position than what you started out in. Obviously, we have to worry about downside, so this is something we have to manage and talk about on a daily basis. But for right now, that's the strategy that I would lean towards for somebody in that situation.
Let's bring the rest of the crew into our conversation. Merrill Crowley, Wayne Nelson, and Kurt Kimmel are here with us as well, and they have been waiting patiently. I think, Merrill, I'll start with you. The Tuesday report from USDA included the first look at what the agency thought might be in the new crop for both corn and soybeans. Which numbers did you like best, and which ones did you disagree with most?
Well, I guess I'd have to say I'm kind of like the informant today. I was thinking that maybe the corn was 2 million acres higher than what it should be, and the beans probably would take up most of that slack. Informant had us 2.8, I think, higher, and the beans down 2.4. Now, I know they weren't going to change that, but it just seems to me like we're the 178 bushel yield and the yield for the beans. It just, to me, seems like the crop's already made. And I realize the last few years, USDA has come out and said, well, we had a great crop even though we had all these problems, only to later then say that, oh, we got to take about 300 men off here. And I kind of still thinking that's what they're going to do this year. So I guess all in all, I wasn't too unhappy with their numbers, but I just think that there's got to be a lot of tweaking from here to the end of the year.
I think it's interesting, if I can jump in for just a second. I was originally thinking the same thing. I thought we'd see a fairly sizable shift out of the 97 million acres of corn into the 83.5 million acres of soybeans. However, in years that we get off to such a good start, you know, I mean, we're, what, the fifth fastest pace on planting on record. Those are years where we usually end up getting very close to the corn intentions, if not maybe slightly over. Now, my problem with that is that at 180.5 million acres of row crops, that would be a new record. I just don't see this as a year for something like that, partially because of prices, partially because of our outlook for, you know, what's going to come in the next year. We're very, very pessimistic about, you know, coronavirus and China trade and everything like that, but then also because of what's going on up in the Dakotas. So I'm wondering if we fall short of both the corn and soybean numbers, but I don't know if we're really seeing a big jump in soybean acres at the expense of corn.
Well, let's stay with acreage. We'll see what Kurt Kimmel and Wayne Nelson think about that. Kurt?
Well, on the corn side of it, I think the 97 is high. If you look at some of the surveys and so forth, there was maybe a slight switch to beans, upwards 2 million acres, but you know, early plantings, guys went at it fairly hard. I don't know. There's probably going to be some adjustments as we move down the road here on it. But in order to get this carry out below or moving south from 3.3 downward, you know, we need to shed 2 million acres. You know, that's going to take 300-350 million off the ending stocks. Then, too, you can start to whittle away on yield. So when you look at the big picture here, assuming we'll have some weather concerns and so forth, the new crop production estimates there are probably the highest ones we're going to see, and we'll have to monitor the crop as we go through the growing season. But I thought it was constructive. Like Ted mentioned earlier, the old crop numbers, you know, they came in, lowered harvested acres slightly, lowered yield slightly. We still have another June grain stocks report to come at us here, so there's some room to see some smaller numbers as we move through the marketing season.
Wayne Nelson, USDA saw fit to add 970 million bushels of usage to the new crop marketing year for corn. Is that too much?
I hope not. It was a big number. It was bigger than a lot of people were expecting. They put ethanol usage back in faster than a lot of people thought it could come back in. Very happily to see that, you know, that Anderson's threw a couple more plants back online. It looks like we're going to see some of the local plants come back online here, and that Poet was going to start up the Shelbyville plant. So those are some things that might help. Also, you know, the talk that China might take the dumping tariff off the DDGs, and we could start moving some DDGs out that would help us to maybe, you know, kick that on up. I think the other thing along the way was with the packing plants coming back on along going, we might not see the reduction in the livestock, and the feed usage is going to continue to be pretty good because I think we're going to continue to have a good meat export meat market to China that way. So some of the stuff along the way that way, I think it was good, but it's probably on the optimistic side. Also, the idea of you know, China has made comments, and they say they are going to come back in and buy some corn here, and it looks like they probably will. So those are all optimistic, and we'd love to see those come true, but we're a little bit iffy on whether they can or not. But like I say, not terribly. As much as we were increasing the production, it was nice to see that they did get optimistic about the usage as well.
So, Merrill, I want to go through these numbers very quickly, and then maybe you can help encapsulate them in some form as to the increase. So total use increase was 970 million. Feed and residual use, and this is year-over-year increases, right? Up 350. Food, seed, and industrial up 245. Ethanol usage was up 250 million, although part of that was because it dropped $100 million for the old crop in this particular WASD set. And then exports at $375 million increase. And they increased last year's, or the old crop, by $50 million. Those numbers all good with you?
Well, again, it's awful early to start at saying what our numbers are going to be out in the future. But anytime you take the price, and as you know, well know, we took the price from, I believe it was 360 down to 340. Oh, no, 360 down to 320, 40-cent difference.
Right.
Anytime you cheapen the price 40 cents, you should collect more demand. And anytime you have big crops, what's the first thing the USDA does is they start to increase the numbers. And so logically, you would think they would increase our demand numbers because the crop that large should put prices at a lower price. Whether that's to be seen on all the way through the year is questionable, but you know, we are starting to see things change. We just started to see some of these big numbers get thrown at us, and personally think that we may have our biggest ending stocks number for corn for the year. Now, that all depends, again, on how the growing season goes. There are several things that I look at. Basically, they're kind of different, but we're talking about La Nina starting to develop. We're talking about drought in the Western Plains, and with the rains we have seen, it still seems to be moving east from the last drought monitor. Warm temps in December and dry Decembers tend to prelude a dry summer. So we've got different things working here that could easily cut this back even more. So like I said, I think we saw the high side. I don't have any problems with them increasing usage because that is the normal tendency that occurs when you have a bigger crop.
Yeah, so it will be a big crop, Ted. And the ending stocks, let's see, for old crop at right at 2.1 billion, new crop at 3.3. So there's about a 1.2 billion bushel increase year over year in ending stocks. Can we really do the demand USDA is talking about?
Okay, so I really like the demand numbers that the USDA put out there. You know, Todd, we've never had a more uncertain year when it comes to the demand side of the equation. We're always uncertain about supply at this time of year or what we're going to grow. But really, as far as demand is concerned, wow, with COVID-19, with China, with everything else going on, it's so difficult to try to make a guess on that. However, you look at the South American corn crop, you say, hey, there's an opportunity here for our exports. I think the increase that the USDA has year over year for exports is maybe my minimal number. I think that number could go up, especially when you think about what can happen to the U.S. dollar when we throw trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars into an economy and create such a large inflationary draft that should put pressure on our dollar and make us more competitive for the rest of the world. Also, I'm really, really friendly for ethanol. We've really seen this market get completely destroyed by the lack of driving and the complete collapse that we've seen in the crude oil market. But think about what that does to crude oil production. You know, just like 2012 brought all the production out for the grains, well, when you get negative crude oil prices, or, you know, more realistically, crude oil prices in the $20 range, that shuts down a lot of production. I mean, maybe up to 60% of our domestic production. So I see the potential for an energy crunch and a huge need for ethanol. At the same time that we're getting an inflationary draft where other countries would be looking for our ethanol, and you just have an upward swelling of prices as well. So I'm optimistic on USDA's demand numbers. They're very similar to what mine were. My ending stocks numbers were about 200 million bushels higher, but that's because of my old crop number, not because of what my production and my usage number is for next year. So I like what the USDA did there. I think they're optimistic, but not overly optimistic. I think those numbers could actually get better. The big question at this time of year is always production, so we'll have to see about that. But, you know, as we were mentioning, there's some reason to believe we could have some issues this growing season. And if it's not perfect, then we can really shrink that $3.3 billion down into a much more reasonable number.
Wait, so go back for me and give me a reason why crude oil in the 20s would result in an increase in ethanol demand.
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, you cut a significant amount of crude oil production, right? But we're still driving. And look, in the last 2 weeks, we've increased the traffic or the driving that we're doing by 60%. Now, keep in mind, I mean, that drops next to nothing. I mean, people are shut in. That's what we're doing. But as we get back online, as we start moving around, we're going to have a need for oil, and we're going to have a need for unleaded gasoline again and fuels and energies as a whole. If we're shutting in a lot of oil production and we're not refining as much, then maybe ethanol has a chance to kind of step in and sort of, you know, take some of that, take a higher percentage of the blend. Maybe E85 gets a little bit more involved. But specifically, what I'm looking for is more exports of ethanol for other countries such as Brazil and China that are looking to fill their energy needs that may not be easily and readily available from crude oil because, again, production has been shut in a lot of places in the world, specifically the United States.
Clearly, Ted and the USDA both are thinking that ethanol usage will be up. The number from USDA, Wayne Nelson, at 5.2 billion bushels used is right at that 15 billion gallon plus, or right at that 15 billion gallon number that is in the RFS. That's a battle cry, actually, within the crude oil industry. They don't want it that high. But it does mean exports would have to be there. However, in order to get exports, doesn't the price of ethanol just have to plummet in order to pull that off? I guess I'm trying to figure out how the economics on this one work, and I don't know whether you or Ted or Kurt or Merrill have some idea about this, Wayne.
Well, of course, along the way like that, some of the countries that are wanting to clear up some of their smog and stuff like that are wanting to add more ethanol. And if we're getting down to 320 corn, you know, basically ethanol can be sold cheaper. It's not going to be quite as cheap as just using the oil, but are we going to have the are some of these countries, will they do and try to clean up some of their stuff as they were looking to? China was wanting to go that way. They're a country that could do some more, and after seeing some of the things that way. But like I say, we do look ahead. It might not be quite that good on everything. You know, the bad part is, as we're looking at all the different businesses now, they're saying we're maybe going to allow more of our people that have worked at home for the last 3 months to continue to do it, and that means less driving, less commuting, and less fuel used. And how fast we get back to the planes, the airlines. When are people going to feel comfortable flying in airplanes again, closed in one, recirculated air, stuff that way? And that's a lot of our fuel, too.
That's the trend now. This gas use is going to definitely go up from what we've been here for the last few weeks, just like Wayne hit it on. Summer vacations, people are going to drive if the government lets them loose here, and that's going to be some incentive there. 5.2 billion bushels, actually, that's about, compared to this last crop year, that's about the third or fourth lowest. So you got to go back to 17. We used 5.6 billion bushels for ethanol. So it's an increase from this year to next year, but it's not like we're setting a record. And I think that demand base is there over time. The key or the concern or question, don't want to be a Debbie Downer here, but if we get a second wave of this virus here this fall, that's the concern there. And, you know, hopefully we can get some vaccines or some medicine here to give some people some comfort. But, you know, if people continue to have to stay home once again, that's going to prolong the problem.
Do you think, Merrill, that if we get to that point, and this is about feed usage as much as anything else, that the livestock supply chain will have been able to correct enough and push enough of the product into the stores that it will continue to chew through enough grain to make USDA's projections?
Well, the key there is, can we keep our workers healthy? And can the processors be depended upon to start including more money to producers and charging less to the consumers? Because, you know, you can't look at restaurants opening up and trying to serve $8 or $12 steak per pound steak to the restaurateurs that are trying to come back. They'll stay at home and try to keep their budgets low if they think another round of COVID is going to come. So, you know, we've seen everything cut. We've seen everything, demand cut for corn, demand cut for ethanol, demand cut for cattle and hogs, demand cut for crude. This all will come back. it's going to be a slow moving item, but it's prices that will bring it back, because once you cut off all the supplies and retool, then the demand will be there because the supplies have been cut off. It's just simple supply demand. Take away the supply, the demand will come after it. So I think long term, it's just we're in a session right now. Corn's probably in the 15% lows. If you take from 2014 to now, we're in the 15% lowest part of the bracket. So I only see corn going up. You've got beans in like the 20% lowest part of the bracket. And so I see beans going to go higher. Sometimes it's not clear where this is going to come from. And I don't think anybody really knows, because we've never been through this. But if you stick to the simple supply-demand, they're going to be in demand return for the ethanol, demand return for the livestock, demand return for corn and beans. And there's two sides. We could go to an inflationary period with all this money being spent. And then one other side I see is Brazil is our biggest competitor because of their real. Their economy is crashing. And I think that's one of the main reasons that their president is telling them they need to go to work, because he can't afford to shut that country down. Their economy would collapse. And I think that's going to provide opportunity for a lot of U.S. products down the road.
Ted, do you have any thoughts on feed usage?
So our kale capacity has gone up a little bit from week to week. So, you know, we're about 12% in cattle. We're about 20% in hog slaughter. So that is starting to come back online. When you offer packers record profit margins, they will find ways to make that happen. I think we will, over time, start to get back, and that feed usage is going to be there, in my opinion. But, you know, we were just talking about Brazil and the issues that they're having there. You know, we haven't really talked about it yet, but the new crop carryover for soybeans, this might be the big story that we have for the summer. At a 405 million bushel carryover, and keep in mind, that's increasing beginning stocks by 100 million bushel. Well, that's a fairly tight balance sheet, and that's not including the idea that China could come in and buy more aggressively here at some point in order to make good on a phase one trade deal, which, by the way, they really should do that. First of all, prices are right for them. And second of all, they are getting such a black eye from the whole world because of this COVID-19 issue. They need to look like they are willing to play ball in the global arena. And by not keeping up with the phase one trade deal, this is a big problem for them. So I believe they should start buying here sometime soon. And if they do, we could shoot through this new crop soybean supply very, very quickly. So it could be a very interesting summer. We need at least 85.5 million acres of soybeans, and we need trend line yield in order to get a relatively decent carryover in soybeans. If anything short of that, or more China buying, all of a sudden you've got beans that could potentially rally $1 to $1.20, $1.30. So, you know, I think that's a very interesting situation. I don't see meal usage going anywhere. The crush is going to remain very strong. The USDA was somewhat reluctant to raise that too much in the current conditions that we have, and I understand that. But I don't see the crush number coming down. It's been really very strong. Feed usage, I think, is going to stay there. Our exports on meal are going to stay there. I have a hard time not being really friendly beans here at this point.
Need seems to be a pretty strong word with China, given that, for instance, they're willing with Australia this week to say, hey, you know what, we don't want your beef and we're going to keep it out. And the Trump administration is saying you need to be punished.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes not. It just seems like there's an awful lot going on there that still needs to be finessed.
Yeah. So Todd, let's say need is a strong word. Let's say it's very much in their best interest to play ball with the rest of the world, or at least to try to make good on some of their promises, because right now you can just feel the anger growing with China, not just from President Trump, not just from the United States, but really the world as a whole is getting very, very frustrated with China. It was about trade, and it still is about trade. But also, you know, the fact that we've had COVID-19 come from them, MERS, SARS, swine flu, all of these major sicknesses seem to be coming out of China. They need to get their stuff together. And it's a problem, right? So the best thing they can do right now is try to save some face, try to look good, try to look like they're being a good citizen of the world. And they have an opportunity to do that. And I'm hoping that they take that opportunity.
True feed usage has been strong. It's going to remain strong. Those livestock numbers are there. We're going through a ton of grain feeding these. You haven't seen a video like you saw out of Asia when the African swine fever hit, just massively doing away with livestock, burying livestock. That's not the case here. We're still moving and feeding livestock. In fact, there's been some real creative things at the local level with these local guys where you've had local hog producers working with the local packer coming in, helping them move the product to the houses 24/7. So the fact is we've got a little problem with cold storage or cooler space there at the local level, but we're going to work through it and just hit it on these slaughter estimates are starting to pick up here over time. But the Department of Justice coming in and taking a look at things, I think is positive, because when you got record or real low cash prices and record cutout values, there's a huge, huge margin, a huge, huge gap there. And I didn't do the math on it, but I thought I saw one study where on beef particularly, when you look at that, the margin on that, they could be paying up towards $2.90 a pound, and they're still down in this $1 to $1.15 area. So, you know, that's something that needs to be looked at, and there's some gaps to fill in through there. But when you step back and look at the big picture on grain particularly, I'm from the early 80s. If you go into mid-80s there, we had over 4 billion bushel corn carryout. Stocks-to-use ratio, 50% on corn, 75% on beans. And we just had massive stocks around. And it wasn't very long, and that kind of disappeared. And what helped the best was the drought at 88. So you get some weather in here and renew some of this demand, these inventories can shrink real quick.
Let's begin to wrap this up. We'll get a final word from each of you. I think Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of Newmarket, Indiana. I'll start with you today.
Well, Todd, the funds are big shorts in this market right now. They've slowed down their selling in the wheat and the beans, but they're continuing to add shorts in the corn. And when they get one-sided too hard, too big, there's a chance for that rally that we were talking about today. So, you know, let's look for maybe a little rally and maybe that we can see the bottom come into this corn market early in June.
Merrill Crowley from First Choice Commodities out of Watseka, Illinois. Your final word?
Well, I think, like I said, we're in the lower part of the range we've been in since 2014, in the lower 15 to 20% of it. I don't see a need to be worried about selling at this particular point unless we're going to go in a full-blown depression, and then it's going to be tough to protect yourself in a condition like that. So when we see a rally, and what we usually see rallies take place when we have large supplies and then we get something to push them up, we usually have these V-type, spike-type tops. So you need to be prepared, have your numbers ready, know what your costs are going to be so you can pull the trigger and take advantage of it, because the highs are going to be hit when your crop is most threatened.
Kurt Kimmel from Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois.
From all of you who've been watching at home and been paying attention here, you've got 100% return on your investment. And what I'm referring to is these pork loins. When these pork loins got below a dollar at the wholesale level, it's kind of suggested to go out, get a few, put it in your freezer. Well, those are now over $2 a pound. So good job if you follow the strategy.
And Ted Seifert from Zahner Ag Hedge in Chicago, Illinois. Your final word for the day.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with the pork loins. You know, pork chops are the new toilet paper when you go to the grocery store these days. So absolutely. But, you know, as I was saying earlier, I look at soybeans, and I think for the second year in a row, this is the market that has a lot of potential to the upside. That potential got spoiled this past year because of failures for China to follow through on their Phase 1 trade deal agreement. But if they were to start to do that, I think there is quite a bit of upside potential for soybeans, and that could really do a lot of good things for corn and wheat as well. So watch out for that. But I agree with the guys. You know, right now, seasonally, we have a tendency to go higher. I don't really see the news getting much worse in the near term, but who knows? So I would be optimistic about prices going up and pushing these funds out of their short position and looking for higher prices to get more aggressively hedged.
Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find and listen to the whole of the program anytime you'd like on our website. The address there is willag.org, willag.org, or find us as a podcast in your favorite podcast application, including Stitcher, SoundCloud, NPR One, Apple Podcasts, and Google Play, along with Spotify. Our thanks go to our panelists this week, including Kurt Kimmel from Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois, Ted Seifert from Zahner Ag Hedge in Chicago, Merrill Crowley from First Choice Commodities in Watsecom, and Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.